You don't have to wait until the opening of the E.M. Forster movie, A Room with a View, to see movies by Merchant and Ivory. The Philadelphia Museum of Art is holding a Merchant Ivory Film Festival this weekend. And for information, you can call 763-8100. That's 763-8100 for more information about this weekend's Merchant Ivory Film Festival at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. This is Fresh Air. You tune to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, and it's now 5 minutes after 4 o'clock. With me on Fresh Air is psychiatrist R.D. Lang, who challenged prevailing psychiatric theories in the 1960s with his books The Divided Self, The Politics of Experience, and The Politics of the Family. Lang proposed that schizophrenia shouldn't be seen as an illness, but as an adaptive behavior, a strategy for living in an unlivable situation. He suggested that madness might be a sane response to an insane world. He attributed the misery of schizophrenia patients partly to the treatment they were subjected to in psychiatric wards. Lang's work was embraced by the counterculture, but was very controversial in the profession. One frequent criticism was that he had romanticized schizophrenia. In 1965, Lang formed the Philadelphia Association, that's Philadelphia for Brotherly Love, which created a network of alternative therapeutic centers for schizophrenics where they wouldn't be forced to receive any treatment that they were opposed to getting. Lang was born in Glasgow, Scotland in 1927 and has lived in London since the mid-50s. His latest books are The Voice of Experience, a follow-up to The Politics of Experience, which discuss the subjective nature of experience, and Wisdom, Madness, and Folly, an autobiography describing the first half of his life. R.D. Lang is in Philadelphia to participate in the American Poetry Center Symposium on World Peace and the Individual. Also participating will be Harold Brodkey, E.L. Doctorow, and Susan Sontag. That will be held at the Philadelphia College of Art tomorrow afternoon between 1 and 3 o'clock. It is open to the public. The event is part of 1986 Poetry Week. For information about the Poetry Week events, you can call 1-800-ALL-MUSE. That's 1-800-ALL-MUSE for more information. R.D. Lang, welcome to Fresh Air. You are still practicing, and are you still following the theories that you first expressed in the 1960s?
Yes. No fundamental change.
Okay. Before we talk about the work that you're doing now, I'd like to go back a little bit and discuss what experiences of yours led to the theories that, you developed. First of all, why did you go into psychiatry?
It was partly an accident or a mistake. I was very concerned about the meaning of life and trying to understand what human existence was all about and what seemed to occasion the fact that human beings, that as I got a glimpse of them, weren't enjoying themselves nearly as much as they might be. Why was this? So that's as much a philosophical or psychological or theological or sociological or anthropological question as it is a medical one. And among other things, I was particularly interested in pursuing the relationship between the mind and the brain. So my first two jobs I had in hospital was one in post-encephalitic Parkinson unit, type of people that Oliver Sacks described in his book Awakenings, and then a job in a neurosurgical unit.
Were you exposed to things while you were being trained and while you were going through medical school that you really opposed, that you didn't want to buy into?
Well, as soon as I put myself in the position of many of the people who were patients, it was quite clear to me
You don't mean
quite
literally
early
put
on.
put yourself in that position.
Well, if I imagined myself in their position, okay. I imagined I wouldn't at all like to be being treated in the way I was expected to treat them, and other people were treating them with the best of intentions, but it wasn't how I imagined I would like to be treated if I was in their shoes.
Specifically, what don't you think you would have liked? What were some of the treatments that were being practiced and taught then that you thought you wouldn't like if you were a patient?
Well, if we confine ourselves for the moment to psychiatry, I wouldn't like to be locked up indefinitely without any serious possibility of appeal. Those days have changed a bit now with the advent of tranquilizers and other so-called antipsychotic drugs, whereby in the last 15-10 years or so in particular, there's been a movement all over the United States and Europe to wind up the institutions of the Victorian-style large mental hospital system. So, but I also would I like to feel that I can experience the world in any way that I happen to experience the world, and I feel other people are entitled to experience the world in their ways. Also, only reason I would want to bring in the law or constraints is when people are treading each other's toes, or worse, when they conduct themselves in a transgressive way. But otherwise, experiential anarchy. Let's agree that we can see things and hear things and take on the world in any way at all without it being forbidden to do so.
You first practiced as an army psychiatrist in the British Army. Did you have any experiences there that you think were pretty crucial in helping to form your ideas? Because I'm thinking that's a pretty... it's a very different way to start than in a private practice or in a civilian hospital. You might have been exposed to either different ways of practicing or patients with a different problems, or at least in a different set of circumstances than a civilian would be in.
I saw a number of people in the army who had been through pretty searing wartime experiences, but that wasn't, I think, really critical. In those days in the army and in general psychiatric practice in general, there were padded cells. Padded cells have rather gone out of fashion these days. I think in some ways a nice, appropriately coloured, padded room with first-rate room service might not be a bad idea for Holiday Inns or some other hotel chain to set up in a special sort of place where you can get to the end of your rope in a way that isn't stigmatising or degrading. In the British Army, I found myself spending quite a lot of time in the middle of the night with people who were in my charge, medical charge, who were in padded cells. And the experience of just hanging out with such people without the usual formalities of medical examination and, doing a usual type of psychiatric interview, sitting behind my desk with a patient at a considerable distance from me, but simply being just hanging out without any side to it, began to make me realize that even such people who were regarded as sort of totally crazy, and crazy enough to be in a British Army padded cell, were not all that different from me. And also that when the initial impression of strangeness and the initial sense of a complete gulf between one's sort of insane state of mind and a sane state of mind evaporated, that such people were not incapable of forming a warm human bond, which was one of the main, and still is to some extent, one of the main psychiatric dictums about certain sorts of people, that they're simply incapable of establishing an ordinary human rapport with other human beings. I felt that they seemed to, with me and me with them, a few of them, establish a sense of camaraderie, even across the distance of being an officer and most of them not being officers.
So you had these experiences in the Army thinking of the schizophrenics that you were working with who were in padded cells as not being totally loony, which is how you thought that much of the profession and much of the quote, sane population saw them. My guest is R.D. Lang, the well-known psychiatrist. You proposed a theory in your book, The Divide Itself, that was different from prevailing theories about schizophrenia, that we basically had two selves, an outer self and an inner self. Can you describe in lay terms for us some of the ideas that you expressed there about what schizophrenia was?
Well, I think as we negotiate with other people in the world in ordinary life, we learn without it being part of the curriculum, but we pick up on the way how to make certain conventional approved signals, such as to crease our mouth up in a particular way, which is called a smile. Or to put our hands out and shake hands with someone else, to stand at a certain distance from other people, not too far away and not too close, or how to sit in a chair, how to cross one's legs sitting in a chair. All these fine nuances of ordinary interaction are conventions that are acquired in a way. Some people find it more difficult to learn these skills than others. Other people find it more intolerable to spend most of the time interacting with people with nothing else but this front that has to be put up. And some people find a discrepancy between how they are expected to present themselves to other people on the one hand and how they're actually feeling on the other, increasing and widening so that it becomes more and more of a strain to keep up a presentation that doesn't, you might say, is it becomes more and more false or less and less honest, less and less candid. But if people who are asked about these things, I mean, ordinary people, most ordinary people who are aware of this zone of life are aware that they pretty well take it for granted that in going into a general store and interacting with strangers and so on, you keep up a certain set of mannerisms which are normal and don't rub people up the wrong way, don't make people too anxious or frightened. I think probably the commonest anxiety in the world today is not agoraphobia, fear of open spaces, or claustrophobia, or fear of the sky falling in, or fear of falling through the floor or something like that, is fear of other people. We're very mistrustful and fearful of each other and very cautious. And that some people seem to find it easier than others to negotiate through ordinary life in that respect.
So your theory proposed in a way that there was an outer self and the inner self, and that the outer self was almost social behavior, and that when it didn't work, when it was no longer functioning for you and you let it down and retreated to your inner self, that would be what we would call schizophrenia?
Well, can think of most of the time, just thinking of our face alone without the rest of the body, most of the time many people where they simply put a mask on. They put their face on, as it were, when they go out the door. And that is a mask. That is simply how we decide we shall present our face to other people. It's not, you might say, our own honest, candid face. We might take that mask off if we've got a home to go back to where one can relax. So there's this persona, this mask, which if we wear it all the time, if it starts, as it were, to stick to our face, if we can never take it off, then can lead to states of feeling quite desperate, isolated, frantic, and in a state of unremitting solitude. And that is a very unpleasant state to get into.
Your theory has been described by a lot of people as saying basically that madness is sometimes a sane reaction to an insane world. Does that seem like an accurate description to you?
Well, I've never actually said that. What I have said in a number of places, particularly in a book that tried to take a number of examples of this book that I wrote with Arne Esserson called what was it called? Madness in the Family. And which I tried to do in the Divided Self also, that the signs, the experiences and the conduct which are taken to be by most psychiatrists and most people the symptoms and signs of psychosis and of schizophrenia in particular are much more socially intelligible, much more comprehensible, much more understandable than have come to be supposed by most people, including most psychiatrists. So I didn't say that people might not be over the wall or out of their ordinary minds, might not be able to share with other people what you might call consensus reality. If we want to say that the absence of being able to share a common shared world or consensus reality is in itself a token of what we're going to call being psychotic, then it is much more intelligible, much more comprehensible, much more understandable, much less difficult to follow how any of us could get into such a state than most people have come to suppose. So I was trying to make the process a little less strange, a little less frightening, and perhaps a little closer to home, a little more familiar.
My guest is psychiatrist R.D. Lang. You, in the mid-60s, I guess, started to set up an alternate therapeutic center for psychotic people, and the idea was to not impose therapies on them. Can you describe your approach that you tried out at that first center and that later got used in a network of centers that you created? What were there treatments that you used, or would you just let people while they were there?
Yeah, there wasn't any treatment that was officially imposed. People were maybe about 20 people living in a place at the time, and it was what I called a free-for-all. There's a principle of what one might call experiential anarchy. That's to say that there's no politics of forbidding or allowing this or that experience. No politics over what you might call, what is called biorhythm. That's to say, in most, maybe all, almost without exception, psychiatric institutions, people are not allowed their own biorhythm. If you want to be awake at night and sleep during the day, if you want to lie in bed in the afternoon, you're not allowed to do so. And if you want to be up walking in the middle of the night, you're not allowed to do that. So the regime is one of regimentation. Everyone's got to get up at the same time, go to bed at the same time, eat at the same time, and the same sort of food at the same time, etc. Everyone's also got to dress in a certain manner. If one says, well, we're not going to have any more of that system between ourselves. Anyone can live as they care to, or as they swing around as they care to. The only thing we will object to is imposing, intruding, impinging oneself on anyone else. So, now there was another motive in this, which was less immediately, obviously, to do with the politics of everyday life, but was this, that from a purely, if you can call it that, medical point of view. And this is the case still with the advent of antipsychotic drugs, tranquilizers and antidepressives and so forth in the 1950s. A whole generation of psychiatrists has now grown up who has got no idea, because they've never ever seen what the natural history, if there is a natural history of a process which is called a psychotic episode, is. Because no one's allowed to go around, if they're diagnosed as psychotic, without being on antipsychotic medication. When I've been in this country in recent years and asked a number of medical schools to, say, interview someone who's called schizophrenic, I've said I would do so if they would find someone who wasn't in medication. It's amazing how far they've had to look to find someone who would be diagnosed in a psychiatric book as suffering from a schizophrenic disorder who is not on medication. And they've had to go and find people who are so-called treatment-resistant characters who are among the street people in order to find anyone who's who has come officially to the attention of the psychiatric world and been diagnosed as schizophrenic who's not on antipsychotic medication.
For the people who were staying at the centres that you created in England, in addition to giving them enough freedom so that they wouldn't have to sleep when the hospital said you had to sleep, and they wouldn't have to stay awake when the hospital said you had to stay awake, you must have wanted to do something beyond that, beyond granting them certain rights, something to communicate with, to them, to help communicate with them, or something to make them more comfortable, if they look like they were in anguish. What were your techniques, and what are your techniques for communicating with someone who is psychotic?
I haven't got any formulae or that I can put my style of operating with other people into that would be like that. It's not so much any additional techniques. It's more a question of subtraction in the first place, dropping. If one's got a mask, or if one is able to put a mask on, then drop it, because people who are like that, though all sorts of people can be diagnosed as psychotic, generally take very badly to being related to by someone else who is operating like a robot, operating with a false professional front, as it were. If we can bring oneself to simply be one's own spontaneous self, for good or ill, without any ambitions to even to help the other person, except through the medium of one's own ordinary human presence, and through the relationship that might be established with another person, with one person to another person. I think that a great deal of the misery, psychotic misery, that I was saying earlier, arises out of the breakdown of ordinary people. Ordinary human-to-human, person-to-person relationship. The other person is not only withdraws and isolated, cowers and cringes away from other people, but other people respond reciprocally by shunning that person.
But do you think that the doctor's role, that you as a psychiatrist should be only trying to communicate straightforwardly without a mask? Is that how you see the role of a psychiatrist, or does it go beyond that?
Well, before a psychiatrist can, in my book, get anywhere beyond that, they've got to get to that baseline in the first place. That's the bottom line. If they can't do that, then forget the rest of it, because then it's just a matter of applications of this matter, this or that technique or skill, which with the people that I'm talking about doesn't seem to cut any ice at all.
The first year, I think, that you had a center like this, you lived at the center for the first year. And I think the place was run non-hierarchically. It must have been very trying for you to live 24 hours a day in this really intense situation where there was not only a different therapeutic approach being tried that was experimental, but there was probably chaos a lot of the time, since there wasn't any order that you were following, and there were, you know, 20 or so patients there, though I don't know that you use the word patient, but they were in realities of their own. So it must have, excuse the expression, been pretty crazy for you to be living under circumstances like that. Did it play havoc with your mental health at all?
I wasn't, for the most part, I wasn't, for the most part, there continually 24 hours a day. I was continuing to work in a West End consulting room for a good part of a working day, but I was living there and sort of there at weekends and so forth, and there every morning and every late afternoon and evening and every night and so forth. I wasn't in a state of total immersion within that system. It becomes a lot easier if there's a lot of people who want to help other people and have that motivation consolidated by a professional institutionalized role that endow them with authority as being sort of nurses or social workers or psychiatrists and so on. If the props of the institutional authority are taken away so that it's a free-for-all, they've got no means of imposing their reality of other people backed up by institutional authority, and at the same time, they've got no way of defending themselves from other people's intrusiveness. In other words, you can't, if you're a doctor and a patient is behaving in a way that alarms you or you're frightened of, and so you can press a button and staff aides will come round and manhunt that person for one. You know, if you can't call upon that sort of help, then you've got to be able to fend for yourself on the basis of a complete free-for-all. I've never taken kindly to anyone trying to do me in. And because someone happens to be out of their mind, or apparently out of their mind, or a patient, I don't see that as any excuse in the least. I'm not making any special allowance for anyone because they happen to be crazy. I expect them to respect me in the way that they expect me to respect them. And it is surprising how quickly and easily that can be established if one's really honest about it. A lot of psychiatrists don't believe that is possible, but then they haven't tried it out.
I'm almost surprised you use the word crazy, because I wasn't really sure that you'd, first of all, want to use a word like that, and second of all, that you'd endorse that kind of distinction between sane and crazy.
Yeah, well, I'm not. I don't want to cast aspersions on. I'm using crazy in a completely non-medical sense. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for and in a non. There's no political power behind my use of the word crazy. I think some people are crazy. A lot of people who are called crazy are not crazy at all. They might be a bit fragile. They might. I was in California, for instance, last year doing a sort of master class with a number of psychologists, and one of them was headed a psychology system that received children referred to them from parent and teachers associations in the Midwest, and he had a problem. He didn't know what to do. He was asking for advice on what he should do. But several children had been referred to him in recent times from parents and teachers association because they had been discovered to be dreaming in colour. Well, you might say that's crazy. Well, not the kids, but the local culture or a number of elements in the local culture become so afraid of their own minds that to dream in colour starts to be regarded as a possible index of something going wrong. You know, all these things are culturally relative. About 90%, I think, of the main characters in the Bible would all be locked up today for hearing voices, because in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which is the psychiatric Bible, it is you're not allowed to hear voices. That's in other words, I think that one's got to be able to use the word crazy without prejudice, and to say that officially there's a moving grid of what is allowed and what is forbidden. For instance, in DSM-3, this Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, you are allowed, for instance, to feel the presence of someone who has died that's close to you for 3 weeks after their death. After that, you're not allowed to anymore. It's classified as a mental disorder after 3 weeks. You know, who on earth has got the right to determine these things and to impose a view of reality upon everyone else?
My guest is psychiatrist R.D. Lang, and he's in Philadelphia to speak at a symposium tomorrow as part of Poetry Week. And the symposium is going to be at the Philadelphia College of Art between 1 and 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Also speaking will be E.L. Doctorow, Susan Sontag, and Harold Brodkey. During the time when you first started talking in these terms in the 1960s, well, let me rephrase that. During the time when the theories that you were discussing were becoming very popular, it was also the time that psychedelic drugs were very popular, LSD, mescaline, psilocybin, and people were having these drug-induced temporary psychotic states, or at least temporary altered states. And I think in part because of that, there was a lot of identification with psychosis and with schizophrenia because people were experiencing such departures from reality. Do you think that the popularity of psychedelic drugs of that period helped the acceptance of your theories? And I'd also be interested in hearing if you if they had much to do with the formulation of your theories as well.
I'd written The Divided Self and Self and Others, Interpersonal Perception, and I'd written most. I'd written three or four of the books that before I got onto psychedelics myself. I think first experience of LSD was in 1961, which was also considerably before the whole thing blew up. In those days, LSD-25 was a perfectly legal drug and quite a lot of European medical use of it. It was perfectly respectable. When the Tim Leary and Richard Alpert and Ralph Metz as a trio started to propound the again, a sort of complete free-for-all as far as drugs went. I'd already had met them, and I thought it was a big mistake.
Why?
To blow out the drug scene like that, because I thought the only thing that could possibly happen would be that there'd be a big backlash against it, and would also induce a sort of quite unrealistic collective fantasy around these drugs that they were going to have some revolutionary effect on society, which I thought was going to be a complete piece of nonsense. And it would completely divert people from seriously considering the actual political political economic situation at the time, which was very much dominated by the existence of the Vietnam War, and would not lead to a clarification and any more skillful expression of compassion for the many people who were very unhappily placed in psychiatric care, and there's very little that ever came out of that that really where people really seriously addressed themselves to their fellow human being. It was from the beginning to end a great deal of self-indulgence about it that I didn't feel happy to be associated with at the time, though I was elected as a sort of cult hero of that movement. I think there's a lot to be, you know, I didn't like it. And I remember one of the generals of the acid revolution in America coming over to London and saying that they would like to set up, they would like to do the same for London, which they had done for the Bay Area in San Francisco, where they unleashed about 300,000 trips in about 24 hours, and to start off the whole flower explosion and hate aspirin and so forth. Would they do it in London? But they felt that, well, if you say no, we won't do it because we regard England as your territory. I thought, if you're asking me, then no. And but otherwise, you know, do what the hell you like.
What were you afraid would have happened?
The same thing has happened in California. I didn't regard that sort of thing that happened with any joy at all. It eventually led to simply a blowout of that sort of thing. I mean, mescaline, magic mushrooms, psilocybin, and the LSD type of drugs have been present in the world from as long as there have been plants and herbs. And a way of an understanding, a knowledge, and a culturally integrated use of these mind-changing plants and herbs and chemicals, I think, is thoroughly desirable in our world. I think our culture is a very psychophobic culture. It's frightened of... among the other ways you can characterize our culture, you could say it's psychophobic. We're frightened. It's a culture that, by and large, is very frightened of the ordinary human mind. Of its, we're allowed a bit of sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell, and consensus reality of time and space. A bit of memory, a bit of imagination, not too much. We're allowed to dream, and that's about all. No voices, no visions, no transformations of experience and so forth and so on. This hitting this head on like that, I thought, was an unskillful way of approaching the situation.
Well,
and I still do.
How did you use drugs like that in your own practice during the time when it was legal?
I'm not going to say it. During the time it was legal, I used it in my own practice.
How would you use it?
Well, I'm not going to say how I used it because even though it was legal, it's still a very sensitive issue. And I'm not going to say how I used it because I haven't, for the same reason, I've never written anything about it. All that time during the period of the 60s and the 70s, I used these drugs a lot in my practice, and I've never felt it appropriate to write about it. But I think there's some things that are better, that discretion in some respects is the better part of valor.
You could tell me if you think this is out of the bounds of discretion, but I'd be interested in hearing if your own experiences with those drugs increased the empathy that you had with the people who you were working with the schizophrenics and psychotics that you were working with. Because of the relativity of experience, as you describe it?
Well, I don't think very much. I've never myself been I very thankful and hope that I don't drift into some of the terrible nightmares of waking life that some people get into. The ordinary human, let's put it this way, because someone is crazy, has never meant to me that I'm frightened of them for being crazy. Therefore, it has never meant to me that I felt that I had to withdraw from them and keep a distance from them, which I could justify by professional etiquette and stance of that order. That human bond, I don't think, which I think is the main factor. Not all the boogaloo, not all the fireworks, not all the excitement, not all the vision and the glory and all the rest of it that can be opened out under psychedelics. It's the ordinariness of the human relationship across, possibly, a very wide difference between the way that two people can be experiencing the world at the same moment. That's the most important thing. I don't think that all the psychedelics that I've had experience of have increased my capacity, such as it is, for compassion.
My guest is psychiatrist R.D. Lang. You have been criticized by some people in your profession for romanticizing schizophrenia and treating it as a valid but, you know, very, very interesting state that has similarities to the artistic vision and artistic expression. How would you respond to those criticisms of having romanticized mental illness?
I think that's total nonsense. All the all sorts of people can get diagnosed as schizophrenic for all sorts of reasons. Among the people who get or have got and might be diagnosed as schizophrenic are people who have unusual experiences of the world in our culture, judged by the standards of our culture, of any kind. Some of these unusual experiences are absolutely miserable and awful, like nightmares. I'm not glorifying anyone because they're in a nightmare of daytime they can't wake up from. I'm saying exactly what Harry Stack Sullivan said a number of years ago, who was one of the most distinguished American psychiatrists of the early part of this century. He said that such people are, more than anything else, simply human. It's an extraordinary statement for someone to have to come out with. I'm not, I think, glorifying people or romanticizing people who are experience the world in a different way. It might be in a state of hypersanity, you might say, or of subsanity, or hyper or hypo. But experiencing the world in a different way from most of their fellows, that's no reason either to idealize them or denigrate them. But on the whole, such people have had a pretty rough time of it. They haven't been treated, by and large, with ordinary respect. Not exceptional respect, but just no loss of respect. I don't see any reason why I should respect someone any less or any more because they are taken to be crazy in our world. It's just evens. There's no difference.
We're running short on time, so let me ask you briefly. The latest theories about schizophrenia are, many of them have to do with chemical imbalances, and there are many psychotropic drugs now that are used to try to create a more proper chemical balance. Do you think that it's true that there are many forms of schizophrenia that are more chemically induced, and what do you think of the use of psychotropic drugs?
You've got to consider the politics of psychotropic drugs. That there are a whole new generation of psychotropic drugs, some of which are banned, and some of which are highly promoted by the drug companies. Many of which are themselves manufactured or are being synthesized in the first place within the laboratories of drug companies. And there's a complex medical political process goes on and is continually going on as to which of such drugs are going to be released to the general public, which are going to be coexist illegally, and so forth and so on. No drug is given medically to someone unless this person's experience or conduct is deemed to be undesirable in the first place. So there are drugs that can stop undesirable experiences, or at least dampen them down. It's a value judgment as to which experience is undesirable. You can't. It's only because an experience which is correlated with a certain sort of neurotransmission or biochemical factors, it's only because the experience is regarded as undesirable that the physical correlates of that undesirable state are regarded as pathological. If the experience was regarded as desirable, the physical correlate of it would be highly promoted.
But we only have a few seconds left, but just to sum up, I mean, do you believe that there are chemical imbalances that can be corrected through the use of drugs, which could improve or clear up someone's mental health problem?
Yeah, possibly, okay. Yeah. But they're not necessarily the drugs that are most highly promoted at the moment.
Okay. You're still practicing?
Yeah.
In private practice?
Mm-hmm.
Do you still believe in the usefulness of the collective, non-hierarchical type approach that you developed
yes.
in 1965? Is that the way that you're practicing now?
Yes. I'm not practicing within a community context at the moment. There's a great deal that we learned about these matters. And as I say, there are several houses in London and a farm outside of Oxford in the London area alone. There are several places in the United States that practice this thing. We only started off, it was the first time ever, as far as we know, in Europe that arena, that space was opened out for the so-called sane and the so-called insane and anyone in any state of mind to live together in a state of a complete free-for-all. So we've learnt a lot about that, and I'm looking forward to, in the next short period of time, writing about it from our mistakes as much as from what might not have been mistakes.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. And my guest has been psychiatrist R.D. Lang, who has been practicing in England since the mid-1950s. He was born in Scotland. He's the author of many books, including The Divided Self, The Politics of Experience. His recent books include Wisdom, Madness, and Folly, which is an autobiography describing the first half of his life, and also The Voice of Experience, which is a follow-up to The Politics of Experience, which discusses the subjective nature of experience. R.D. Lang is in Philadelphia to participate in the American Poetry Center Symposium on World Peace and the Individual. That's tomorrow afternoon. The other participants will be Harold Brodkey, E.L. Doctorow, and Susan Sontag. It will be held at the Philadelphia College of Art between 1 and 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. The event is part of the 1986 Poetry Week. The symposium is open to the public. There is a phone number you can call for more information about this and other Poetry Week events. The number is 1-800-ALL-MUSE. That's 1-800-ALL-MUSE. R.D. Lang, thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.
It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock. Because of the holiday, we have no shadow traffic report today. But let me tell you what's happening next week on Fresh Air. Sunday at 6 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be jazz singer Abby Lincoln. Comedian Joe Piscopo is about to open in a new movie called Wise Guy. And Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we're going to feature an interview with him. At 4 o'clock Monday afternoon, we begin a new round of the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series. Marion McPartland is a jazz pianist, and for the next 13 Mondays at 4 o'clock, we'll hear her joined by a guest pianist for interviews and duets. Her first guest will be pianist and singer Mel Torme. Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by Ed Hermance, the owner of Giovanni's Room, which is a bookstore that specializes in gay and feminist literature. We're going to discuss the seizure of books that he exported to England, which has become a major obscenity case in that country. So that's Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock next week, we'll be joined by comedian Phyllis Diller. So I hope you can be tuning in. That about does it for today's program. Millie Moffitt was gave production assistance. The engineer today was Ron Barron. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller, co-producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very good weekend. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Wendy Kaufman.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
Almost seemed like a game to me. I came fresh out of school, and I came in here and learned how to do this stuff, and now it's more real, and it's a little scarier.
Johnson Space Center, Houston. The training goes on for future missions of the space shuttle as the search goes on for the cause of the Challenger's explosion. That story tonight on All Things Considered.
Also these stories, Adlai Stevenson to run as an independent for governor of Illinois.
In Alaska, a volcano erupts, causing concern and clouding the sky.
A report from the West Bank and life under the authority of both Israel and Jordan.
A big price hike for General Motors cars.
And some Kansas basketball memories.
That and more coming up on All Things Considered. Now we have this hour's news.
This is Laurie Waffenschmidt. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega admitted today that Sandinista troops had crossed the border into Honduras. At a news conference, Ortega justified the incursion by saying Nicaragua doesn't consider the area near the border Honduran territory. He said it had been converted into a battle zone by the Contra rebels. Ortega said the action by the Sandinistas was not an invasion or aggression, but self-defense against people who are attacking the Nicaraguan government. Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi said today that U.S. warships did not cross the so-called line of death during this week's confrontation in the Gulf of Sidra. Gaddafi also repeated claims that Libyan forces shot down 3 U.S. jets. The U.S. has denied those charges. Meanwhile, the Navy task force involved in the operation carried out routine operations today in the northern Mediterranean, away from the contested area near the Libyan coast. After a week of criticizing the U.S. for a nuclear test in Nevada and its military action in the Gulf of Sidra, Soviet officials today eased their attacks on American foreign policy. But Foreign Ministry spokesman Valery Sukin still wouldn't say when or if Soviet leaders will set the date for another superpower summit. The BBC's John Osman reports from Moscow.
Mr. Sukin rejected a suggestion from an American correspondent that the Russians were now less interested in a summit encounter between Mr. Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev than they had been, although he stressed that such a summit should be held in the context of efforts which had started at Geneva, directed towards a better international climate and the search for ways to prevent nuclear war. Mr. Sukin indicated that recent American actions had gone in the opposite direction. Such actions, he believed, would have an impact on what he called the final decision by our country on whether or not the present Soviet moratorium on nuclear weapons testing would be extended beyond its deadline next Monday. That decision, he added, had not yet been taken. but when it was, then it would be notified. There are hints here that there may be an announcement this weekend.
BBC correspondent John Ospin in Moscow. Secretary of State George Shultz traveled to Rome today under heavy security because of terrorism.